From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, the US says airstrikes on Iraq are possible. So too are talks on the crisis there with neighboring Iran.
We're open to discussions if there's something constructive that can be contributed by Iran.
We'll have an update from Baghdad and from Syria on the mood of anti-government rebels there. Also today, talks collapse and Russia turns off Ukraine's gas supply. We'll get the latest from Brussels. And the retired tennis ace who thinks he can help solve the world's chronic shortage of drinking water.
Ideally, how you can explain to people in a really simple form is that we can make it rain every day.
That's Wayne Ferreira. You'll hear from him and the rest of our program after our summary of the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The Obama administration says it is willing to consult with Iran on the rapidly deteriorating situation in neighboring Iraq. Islamic militants have captured the city of Tal Afar, and reports of mass killings of Iraqi soldiers have been condemned by the United Nations as likely war crimes. Our Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff reports.
In an interview with Katie Couric for Yahoo News, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Washington is open to working with Tehran.
We're open to discussions if there's something constructive that can be contributed by Iran.
But that coordination has its limits, says U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki.
We're not talking about coordinating any military action in Iraq with Iran. We would encourage Iran to push the Iraqis to act to address problems in a non-sectarian way.
For now, the Obama administration is still mulling its military options, having sent the aircraft carrier, the USS George H.W. Bush, to the Persian Gulf and having promised not to commit troops, while urging Iraq to invest in a political process for a peaceful future.
Ukraine says Russia has cut off all gas supplies after Kiev failed to settle its multi-billion-dollar debt. The decision by Russia's main energy company, Gazprom, comes after weeks of negotiations between Ukraine, Russia, and the European Union over gas. Anya Ardayeva reports from Moscow.
According to Ukrainian Energy Minister Yuri Prodan, gas supplies to Ukraine have been reduced to zero. Russia's energy giant Gazprom said Ukraine now has to pay up front for its gas deliveries after a deadline for Ukraine to pay $1.95 billion expired on Monday. Gazprom said in a statement that Ukraine will now receive Russian natural gas only in the amounts it has paid for. The company said it would continue to supply European customers with gas, and that Ukraine had to make sure the gas transited through the country. Kyiv said it had enough gas in its underground storage facilities to last until December. On Monday, both Gazprom and Ukraine's state energy company Naftogaz filed lawsuits against each other in the Stockholm Arbitration Institute.
Formula One racing champion Michael Schumacher is no longer in a coma and will switch to a new hospital to continue his recovery. The move came somewhat unexpectedly after a lack of updates recently on his condition. Iris Spitzer reports from FSN's bureau in Berlin.
The German racing legend spent almost 6 months in a medically induced coma after suffering a head injury while skiing in the French Alps. Now he'll be leaving the hospital in Grenoble, France, to continue his recovery at a facility in Lausanne, Switzerland. Schumacher's family hasn't revealed much about his condition or prognosis since the accident, but they have said that he faces a long, hard fight and that his recovery will take place away from the public eye. Schumacher won a record 7 Formula One championships between 1994 and 2004.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. In Washington, U.S. President Barack Obama is set to sign a ban prohibiting federal contractors from discriminating against gay or transgender employees. Gay rights advocates have long put the White House under pressure to make the move. Here's Alice Olstein from Washington.
You can't be fired or denied promotion in the United States because of your race, age, religion, or gender. But in many states, you can still be singled out at work for your real or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity. With federal legislation to ban such discrimination unlikely to pass Congress this year, President Obama announced Monday that he will use his executive authority to mandate legal protections for federal contractors, who make up nearly a quarter of the U.S. workforce.
Coffee giant Starbucks has said it will help pay college tuition fees for its U.S. workers. The American coffee chain says it wants to help the spiraling debt amounts of college graduates in the U.S., following a report that showed college leavers owe a total of more than $1 trillion. Nick Harper reports.
The cost of going to college in the U.S. is an expensive undertaking, with many graduates leaving thousands of dollars in debt. To help with that, Starbucks is offering money to any of its U.S. staff, who work more than 20 hours a week, to complete a bachelor's degree at Arizona State University. There's no obligation for the graduates to return to work at Starbucks after completing their four-year course. Last week, the White House signed a bill capping loan repayments, after a report showed student loan debt has rocketed from $250 billion to more than $1 trillion in the last 10 years.
For the rest of the day's news, you can follow us on Twitter at Feature Story. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. We begin today with Iraq. Secretary of State John Kerry has articulated what was once unthinkable, the possibility of talks with Iran over the crisis in Iraq, and perhaps even military action that would be coordinated with Tehran. He also said US-led airstrikes on Sunni militant positions are under consideration. The Obama administration is continuing to determine its response to the rapid advances that forces with ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, have made over the past week. Mr. Kerry's comments came in an interview with Yahoo News, and the interviewer was Katie Couric.
Do you think ISIS is going to take Baghdad?
I don't believe that they will in the near term, certainly, and I don't believe they necessarily can at all, but that remains to be determined by the decisions that are made over the course of the next few days. Our decisions, their decisions, the decisions of the larger community, the decisions that Prime Minister Maliki makes, all of these are critical to what's going to happen.
You know, it's been reported that the U.S. has drones flying over Iraq to gather intelligence. But a lot of analysts over the weekend were talking about the fact that airstrikes are not going to be effective because there are members of this organization scattered among the population at large. So what's your response to airstrikes just aren't the answer here?
Well, they're not the whole answer, but they may well be one of the options that are important to be able to stem the tide and stop the movement of people who are moving around in open convoys and trucks and terrorizing people. I mean, when you have people murdering, assassinating in these mass massacres, you have to stop that. And you do what you need to do if you need to try to stop it from the air or otherwise. If Americans obviously feel very powerfully about not putting boots back on the ground in Iraq. So we'll consider what options are available to us. But you cannot allow that march, I think. I mean, it's our basic judgment of most people in the region that you can't just let them run whole hog over the country for any number of reasons.
Will you reach out to Iran, and how can that country be helpful, or is that like entering into a hornet's nest? Because
well,
that will inflame the Sunnis.
Look, we're open to discussions if there's something constructive that can be contributed by Iran. If Iran is prepared to do something that is going to respect the integrity and sovereignty of Iraq and the ability of the government to reform.
Can you see cooperating with Iran militarily?
At this moment, I think we need to go step by step and see what, in fact, might be a reality. But I wouldn't rule out anything that would be constructive to providing real stability, a respect for the Constitution, a respect for the election process, and a respect for the ability of the Iraqi people to form a government that represents all of the interests of Iraq.
John Kerry talking there to Katie Couric of Yahoo News. He seemed to confirm, as you heard, that the U.S. believes pictures published this weekend by ISIS do show the mass execution of Iraqi soldiers captured near Saddam Hussein's birthplace of Tikrit. The militants claim to have summarily executed 1,700 soldiers after storming their base, and gruesome photographs of the men apparently being led to their deaths are ubiquitous today on the internet and in social media. After taking the city of Tal Afar, ISIS claimed on Monday to have captured a senior Shiite general with a long track record of brutally targeting allies of Saddam Hussein. They said they would execute him publicly to serve as a warning to others. Reports of his capture, like so much else on the ground in Iraq, have not been independently verified. Correspondent Martin Chuloff of Britain's Guardian newspaper is in Baghdad, and he spoke to Nick Ferrari of Britain's LBC Radio.
It's a very, very difficult conflict to cover. We need to be extremely accurate in what we are reporting, particularly about sectarian massacres or reported sectarian massacres such as that which you mentioned. Those images published overnight of Shia soldiers from the Iraqi National Army being captured and executed in the deserts just outside of Tikrit are accurate. And so too are accompanying videos which show them being taunted before they were killed. There is grave concern about the whereabouts of 2,000 other Shia soldiers captured in the same raid by Islamic insurgents. There have been some claims by these insurgent groups that they've all been killed. I'm not sure that that's the case, but certainly 50 to 80 of them have, and that is galvanizing a profound response by Shia communities in Baghdad and elsewhere in the country who really are joining this battle along sectarian lines, not nationalistic lines. Sectarianism seems to be taking primacy over any allegiance to a nation state at this point, and that's very dangerous.
How much is there a danger, Martin, of which I'm sure you and hopefully your colleagues are acutely aware, that in a way you're doing a bit of a campaign job for ISIS here, in that you have to be careful how many of these images you put up and how you depict them?
I can't see how that's campaigning for them. I mean, revealing the scale of their atrocities, what they're prepared to do, certainly doesn't reflect well on the organisation. But what it does do is it exposes the fault lines that are rapidly emerging in this community. And the images or the moments in time that are being seized upon by once in what is an emerging civil war here to continue to organise and mobilise. So, you know, publishing such images just reflects the full scale of the horror. It doesn't amplify ISIS's cause, to the contrary.
Just briefly, while we have the benefit of you on the line, what do you see as the next key events over the next 48 hours or so, Martin?
Well, the Shia volunteers who have been mobilising in Baghdad in the last 3 days are moving to the northern entrances to the city. They are aiming to take the fight to these insurgent groups. They are manning defences in the west of Baghdad as well. And I anticipate that the so-called advance on Baghdad won't happen. It's simply because ISIS is an insurgent organisation. It has been operating in Baghdad for many years. It's very capable of blowing things up more or less when it wants to, as it did last night, 5 different bombs all around us here. It's a different story, though, to advance from the capital as a military formation. So my take is that this will settle into a classic counterinsurgency, sort of a guerrilla warfare campaign, which will keep the country unstable for a long, long time, but not necessarily take it too much further into the abyss.
That's Martin Chuloff, a correspondent with Britain's Guardian newspaper in Baghdad. He was speaking there to Nick Ferrari of Britain's LBC Radio. Later on the programme, we'll look at the current mood of opposition rebels in Syria as they continue their battle against President Bashar al-Assad. This is FSN Reports. The Russians today turned off the taps. They cut all gas supplies to Ukraine after talks aimed at negotiating Kiev's $4.5 billion debt to Moscow collapsed. Russia's state-owned Gazprom, a conglomerate with impeccable ties to the Kremlin, says the Ukrainians must now pay upfront for any gas they import from Russia. The Ukrainian government says it's got enough in storage to get the country through until December, but as FSN's Europe correspondent Jack Parrock reports from the now defunct talks in Brussels, the outlook for a resolution remains opaque.
Europe sees around 15% of its supply of natural gas come over Ukrainian soil, which is why the EU has been keen to be the one mediating the talks between Russia and Ukraine. The Russian gas company Gazprom says it will only supply Kiev with gas which has been paid for up front now. Europe is concerned about what the ramifications on its own supply might be. But the European Commission says the danger of a serious shortage is still a long way off due to how much gas Ukraine has stored. Sabine Berger is the EU's energy spokesperson.
In order to have a safe supply in winter for the EU, Ukraine storages should be filled, and the storage should amount to around 18 to 20 billion cubic meters at the end of summer. This is why we think it's important also to find a solution and to enable a filling of the storages.
The dispute centres around debt repayment and the price Ukraine pays for gas, which went up by 80% after the fall of the former Ukrainian government. In recent talks, the two agreed on a winter price of $835 per 1,000 cubic metres, but Russia refused to allow a summer price drop to around $300, which was part of an EU proposal. As far as European concerns go, energy experts like Dr. Arno Behrens, who's an energy expert at the Centre for European Policy Studies, say it's not in Russian interest to prolong the dispute.
I think that they will get back together on the table. You have to see that the market in terms of volume of Ukraine is one of the biggest destination markets of Gazprom, equal to the size of Germany, about 30 billion cubic meters per year. So there is clearly also an interest for Gazprom to supply this market, and of course what's maybe more important, to be perceived and to continue to be perceived as a reliable supplier, which is also in the interest of Gazprom in terms of its downstream diversification. You have seen the deals being struck with China. There are possibilities with other countries in the East, and therefore Gazprom is not interested in a long-term disruption of relations.
The situation in eastern Ukraine isn't perceived to be improving, making diplomatic tensions harder to resolve. But the EU says it's still not pessimistic about the prospect of getting Russia and Ukraine back around the negotiating table and preventing the two sides from taking the issue to the arbitration court in Stockholm. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
Now, the eyes of the world may well be on the World Cup in Brazil, but the Wimbledon Tennis Championships are just a week away. And today on the programme, we have a story about one of South Africa's greatest international tennis players, Wayne Ferreira. He is retired from the sport now and is working on a project that turns air into pure drinking water. It's an effort that could help solve the world's water shortages. Ferreira lives in California today, a state facing a terrible drought, and he's running a company called Ecolo Blue. From FSN's bureau in San Francisco, Rebecca Bowring reports.
This is obviously our home office unit. It's the smallest one that we have.
From the well-irrigated lawns of Wimbledon Tennis Club to the parched soil of Northern California, Wayne Ferreira has crossed continents to head up a business pioneering sustainable technology. His atmospheric water generators, or AWGs, look a little like water coolers. But behind the plastic casing lies a system for condensing water molecules in the air into water that you can drink.
It's a very simple concept, taking the humidity out of the air. So what the machine does is it has a condenser, so it sucks in air, it condenses the humidity out of the air. Kind of freezes it.
Ferreira says that at 70% humidity, Ecolo Blue's smallest unit can produce up to 30 litres of water a day. He learned about the technology many years ago, but waited to retire from tennis before jumping into a new career in water sustainability.
Ideally, how you can explain to people in a really simple form is that we can make it rain every day.
Physiotherapist Michael De Benedetto was one of Ecolo Blue's customers embracing water self-sufficiency. Wary of impurities, he's been filtering tap water for decades and says he loves the science behind the AWG.
It has advantages over many other systems, and there's something magical about just knowing that you're getting pure drinking water from the air. There's something really cool about that, and there's an educational side to it as well for young kids, because they find it fascinating.
Ferreira and his team hope to improve water access across drought-stricken California. They're in talks with several local water boards, as well as the military, including the National Guard. and they're working on large-scale solutions for further afield, like 40-foot containers that can be deployed in refugee camps following a disaster.
This is perfect for an emergency solution, or more of an emergency preparedness.
Ecolo Blue's technology is already being sold in the Middle East, the Philippines, and in China, where it's manufactured. And Ferreira's confident it has potential applications in South Africa too.
It's my, you know, my home, so I ideally would like to get it in there. Africa in general is difficult to work with a lot of different governments, but there's a huge need for it there, and we're starting to get a little bit more feedback and a little bit more interest in it.
Former international tennis great Wayne Ferreira talking there to FSN's Rebecca Bowring. Next tonight, FSN Spotlight. And while the world is focusing on the worsening situation in Iraq, we have an update on the mood of anti-government rebels in Syria. After President Bashar al-Assad secured another term in office in the country's presidential election, the rebels trying to oust him from power, dismissed by the government in Damascus as terrorists, are riven with infighting. But there are also indications that they've started to receive more international assistance than before, according to Sarah Burke, the Middle East correspondent for The Economist. She's just returned from a reporting trip to Syria and Turkey, and she spoke to the paper's Leila Malana Allen about the mood among the rebels.
It tends to go up and down. I mean, recently, obviously, there's a lot of depression about the fact that 3 years on, there's been no help, and they're obviously aware that they're losing ground and also losing popular support as people get tired of the war, as corruption grows among rebel ranks, as it becomes quite clear that there's not going to be a military victory. And a lot of Syrians feel that the opposition doesn't represent them. They hate the regime, but there's no alternative that they see. But morale has been boosted of late, because in the last few months, there's been a push and increase and aid coming from Western allies and Gulf allies of the opposition. So that sparked some hope.
So why has there been an increase in aid, and who exactly is giving it?
It's all a little bit murky, but there's definitely a coalition of friendly states, including America, Britain, France, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, who've long been giving odd bits of aid, be it lethal or otherwise, but often just on their own initiative. Recently, they've decided, first of all, to become a little bit more coordinated. And second of all, there's a real fear with the rise of extremist-minded groups such as the Islamic State of Iraq and Greater Syria, which used to be part of al-Qaeda and now has split from them and seems in many ways more extreme, that if Syria is left alone, then Bashar al-Assad will stay and the rest of the opposition will be held by extremist groups who have better sources of funding.
Now, one of the main concerns about giving rebels aid was the fact that it could fall into the wrong hands. So has something happened to alleviate those concerns?
I mean, those concerns are still there, but what's been given is very small, almost pilot amounts of aid to check supply lines. And so far, it seems that things haven't fallen too far into the wrong hands. Now, that's partly because where aid appears to have been given is in areas where al-Qaeda-minded groups have been kicked out, and therefore the aid is less likely to be snatched or taken from the groups it's given to.
But it sounds like these are really small amounts that won't be enough to actually shift the balance of power on the ground between the regime and the opposition. So what exactly is the point?
It's changing incentives for rebel groups to become more palatable to Western and Gulf donors. So we've seen some Islamist-minded groups coming out with statements saying that they want freedom, they have the same aims of toppling the regime. Now, it's unclear how genuine those statements are, but at least they see the need to make them.
And what's life actually like day-to-day for people living in rebel-held areas?
So day-to-day life is obviously very difficult and has become much more difficult. And lots of the rebel-held areas are now emptied out of people. There's no one left there. For those that remain, there's a lot of violence still from the regime in terms of barrel bombs being dropped. In some cases, there's insecurity with rebel groups they don't know and don't trust. It's very hard to get food. It's very expensive. I've talked to some Syrians who've been in to visit family members who remain in the north. He talks about the psychological problems as well that they have. So life is very difficult for those that do remain.
And what about for the rebels themselves?
For the rebels themselves, they say it's harder to get supplies at the moment, notwithstanding the ones that are obviously sanctioned from donors. But the borders are more tightly controlled as Turkey, especially in Jordan, worry about extremist groups. So ISIS holds three border crossings with Turkey, and Turkey shut those entirely. So both rebels and Syrians find it harder to move in and out of the country.
ISIS was rapidly expanding their power base, but it seems like recently they've faced some setbacks. What's the state of play now?
So ICE is an incredibly powerful group. I mean, they have very good funding, partly from ransom, partly from their connections with other like-minded groups. And they've got very good organization and very experienced fighters. Now, what they don't have is a social base among the Syrian people, who have generally been quite moderate and don't like the image that ISIS have. And ISIS, when they were holding certain towns, treated Syrians generally very badly, telling them they couldn't smoke, which is something almost all Syrians do, telling them what to wear, telling them what they could and couldn't do in public spaces. So other rebel groups, with the support of local populations, have pushed ISIS back towards the east of the country. But having said that, they still control the only city that's not in Mr. Assad's hands, Raqqa. And they also still control lots of the countryside east of Aleppo. So it's not like they've disappeared. In the areas now that they've been pushed out of, civil society has started to flourish a little bit again, and you're seeing NGOs becoming more active and people starting to go in again.
Now, Mr. Assad's just won another term in office in what amounts to a sham election. So what impact is that victory going to have on the situation in the country?
I think the election is a confidence booster for Mr. Assad and for his supporters, and dampens the morale of an opposition that, although it sees it as an illegitimate election, realizes that it gives the impression to the world that he is in control. And one of the things I've heard them saying a lot is that even if there's not more aid given from friendly states, maybe they could try and delegitimize the regime and legitimize the opposition. So simple things such as giving the opposition the authority to grant internationally recognized Syrian passports, for example, which those Syrians who have proved to be opponents to the regime are no longer able to renew their passports. I think the international reaction to it will largely, it's been seen as a sham election and it's going to be ignored. But obviously allies of the Assads, including Russia and Iran, are going to hold it up as the first multi-party elections in Damascus, and therefore this is the Syrian people having chosen their political future.
So Sarah, what comes next? Can the rebels hold out? And what about the Syrian people?
It very much depends on Western and Gulfy support. If it increases, then we might see a change on the ground. I very much doubt that's going to happen. Most Syrians want the war to end, and a lot of them now don't really care how that happens. But the only problem is all of them realise that if Mr. Assad does stay, that doesn't lead to a peaceful solution either.
That's Sarah Burke, Middle East correspondent for The Economist. She was talking to the newspaper's Leila Malana Allen, and you can read her reporting every week in The Economist and online at economist.com. We did not want the programme to end tonight without a pause to pay tribute to two well-known voices that were silenced over the weekend. One of them, of course, was Casey Kasem, and we have been struck today by the extent to which the rest of the world has paid attention to his passing. Best known here in America as the host for 39 years of his weekly radio chart show, outside the country, Casey Kasem will forever be remembered as the voice of the hippie slacker Shaggy on Scooby-Doo. It wasn't his first choice on the Scooby-Doo project.
The character I wanted to do was Fred. And so they said, no, we'd like you to read the other character, Shaggy. I said, oh, okay, well, what is it you want? And he said, well, come up with something. And what I came up with was, Scoobo, buddy, old friend, old pal, it's me, your friend Shaggy.
Casey Kasem, who died over the weekend at the age of 82. The second voice silenced, that of British actor Francis Matthews. He was 86 and is best known for playing the role of another children's television character, Captain Scarlet, the indestructible action man who battled the Mysterons in the 1960s. He was picked for the part because of his ability to sound uncannily like Cary Grant.
Let's see. If I remember the map correctly, our present course would take us to the Humboldt Sea.
What is your interest in that area?
Oh, a natural curiosity. It's on the far side of the moon, never visible from Earth.
Francis Matthews and Casey Kasem, both of them had depth and extraordinarily wide careers, and both found fame in off-camera roles on children's television. We leave you tonight with the Captain Scarlet theme tune. I'm Simon Marks for everyone with FSN Reports Everywhere. Have a great evening. Till tomorrow, goodbye. What he's worth, Captain Scarlet.